Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell at ESPN. It's Thursday, June 21st, 2018. A lot to get to today on the show. We're going to get to the World Cup, of course, going on right now with Mike Goodman of many different websites and podcasts in a moment. First, we're going to talk about the NFL. We got to our offseason grades recently with Mina Kimes and Field Yates, and someone who writes about the offseason grades from a different perspective with the help of several NFL executives and personnel people around the league, coaches, all kinds of people who know a lot more than I do, and someone who knows more than I do in general as well, actually, is ESPN's Mike Sando. And so we're going to talk to him about his the offseason grades that he compiled from talking to NFL executives. So, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great.
I am happy to talk about this. I'm always fascinated by grades. And I think there's some interesting discussions to have because, you know, I had my opinions and Mina and Field had their opinions. And, I think a lot of times we agreed and I don't disagree with a lot of these, but there are a few who I do actually, I find really interesting discussions to be had there because there's, you know, different ideas about how to build a team, what constitutes success. And so, and of course you're someone who has your own opinions and are usually right about things pretty frequently as well. So I wanted to talk about, you know, a bunch of those teams that we might disagree on, or there might be some disagreements on, and kind of figure out, you know, where those disagreements lie and if there's anything interesting to be had there. So I wanted to start with the team that is the top of the charts for you, the team that had the highest grade for this offseason, and that is the Los Angeles Rams, who got an A-.
Bill Polian used to always tell me, now, off-season grades are fun, but just remember they have nothing to do with what's going to happen during the season. And I've always felt that away because I think that's true. I mean, I think we're grading things that do impact the future of the team, but don't necessarily completely translate to how it's going to go during the season. So I think that's an important disclaimer. When you look at the Rams, though, what are we grading? Are we grading the attempt to make your roster better? Because I think they did some interesting things, like the process to me of adding veteran players who are still either in their prime or even approaching their prime, who are already under contract or not going to take a killer contract, or in the case of Sue, who've been released, you're working that comp pick system in their case, so they're getting a bunch of picks out of this. They're adding players and getting rewarded as if they're losing players. There's a lot of boom or bust to it, but I sort of reward them for trying. I think they may fall flat on their face, but they're going to go down swinging.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting plan for them, and I think the comp picks part is something that really wasn't talked about very much in the process because we were so focused on the guys they added that you kind of didn't really even, or at least I didn't really even pay attention to the guys that they let go, and picking up 2 third-round comp picks for them is very nice. However, you look at this year's draft, they went missing. They weren't there. They were able to go on vacation for most of the draft process because they, you know, traded picks for Brandon Cooks, Marcus Peters, Aqib Talib, talented veteran players, but guys who, you know, you'd figure it's going to help the 2018 team, but in the long run, there's going to be basically a missing crater from this year's draft for this Rams organization.
Possibly. I mean, I was an analytics director. I was talking to about this this offseason. Says actually, they came away with 11 picks, and if you look at the way they did it, it was kind of impressive. And I don't have their picks in front of me, but I think there's a couple thirds in there, a couple fourths. They had some concentrated at the sort of in that potential sweet spot area, depending how you think. I mean, I think most people would want the second round to be part of that too, but they did get volume in the draft, and we'll see, you know, who knows if they've hit on the players or those are good picks. I think we'd all be guessing, but it wasn't like Tennessee, which came out of this, which traded up twice and came away with 4 picks.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, I like my chances better with 11. So, you know, to defend them to some degree, they did have a big draft class. We'll see, you know, if those players are any good. I think they're just the most interesting team. And it's funny, I have all these conversations and then I've got everything together. And then this is how it works. By the end, I'm like, oh yeah, it's grades. Now I got to add grades to it. And that's like kind of the hardest part because I think these analyses sometimes defy the grades. We're sort of debating what's going to happen. And I think with the Rams, you could easily give the Rams a C- if you thought this isn't how you build a team.
Yeah, and I mean, it could be the wrong way to build a team. I don't think we really are going to know for a while, but you know, certainly the core is still there. I don't think anyone faults them for going after Brandon Cooks and Marcus Peters in terms of adding talent. you know, you could make a case that with Marcus Peters and Aqib Talib, these are two players who, you know, their teams weren't necessarily desperate to keep around the Broncos for cap reasons with Aqib Talib, and he has dropped off a bit with age. Marcus Peters seemed like there was there was not a fit in terms of his personality. Certainly, it seems like they want to leverage their coaching staff, leverage Sean McVay, leverage Wade Phillips into sort of managing those personalities. But it does seem like there's a lot of, like you said, boomer bust possibility here, where we could be sitting here and saying they got all these great players for second, third, fifth round picks, but then we could also see it going really south.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting to me, too. A young offensive head coach, and he adds all of these personalities and interesting folks on the defensive side and says, Wade Phillips, you just figure it out. And I think Wade's like, hey, I'll do it. This is what I do. Let's go. He's not worried about it at all. But when you look at their defense, and when you look at Wade Phillips's defenses, not that this is entirely different from a lot of defenses, but remember when he was in Denver, it's all about get the pass rushers and have the cover corners. Well, where are the pass rushers? They have good interior rushers. Obviously, Sue's the best in the league. I mean, Donald's the best in the league, and Sue is a good one. But look at their outside linebackers. Where's the edge rush on this team? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that an important part of the equation?
It certainly does seem like it. With Matt Longacre might be their top defensive end right now. Michael Brockers might pace them outside as well, but he's, you know, defensive tackle moving outside. So it's interesting. You kind of figured they would have gone out maybe with the last little bit of cap space they had left and gone out and signed a veteran at the very least. Maybe they bring back someone like Connor Barwin, who, you know, is not necessarily going to be a 10 sack guy on the edge at this point of his career, but might be someone just to give them a body on the outside who can, you know, compete. And you figure with all the veterans they have in this team, they would probably want to attract, you know, some of those outside edge rushers who might want to try and compete for a Super Bowl.
Yeah, and is it a good thing to be bringing in all these personalities and you haven't even re-signed Aaron Donald, who's the one guy in your entire organization who's earned it the most? There's something about this that feels fleeting, that feels like it's a 1 or 2 year play, but it makes them exciting too. And I think that's not accident. I think you almost have to be exciting in LA to get people's attention. And so it's a debatable grade. I mean, I gave them the A- because in the end, I was persuaded by one of the guys I was talking to saying, "Hey, what are we grading here? They've made a bunch of moves to try to make their team better. Isn't that what you try to do in the off season?" And it's like, well, yeah, I'll buy it. But could I easily argue the other side of it? Yeah, and that's part of this grade too. You know, it's like, I'm not 100% sure what to make of it. I just can't wait to see it.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to the rest of the teams here in a second. But first, just in general, are you ever in a bathroom in your daily life? Well, I am. I don't know about you. If you're not, that's fine. Good for you. But I think the vast majority of people are. And if you happen to go to the bathroom at any point, whatever you're doing in the bathroom, Dollar Shave Club has stuff to help you out. If you shower, if you brush your teeth, if you try to make your hair look presentable, if you have hair, not all of us do, hint, hint, but if you do, Dollar Shave Club has stuff to make you look, feel, and smell your best. Anything in the bathroom you're going to do, Dollar Shave Club can help out with. If you want to go in the shower, you want to clean yourself up, well, there's shampoo, conditioner, body wash, all of which smells great, all of which is going to help you be clean and presentable. If you happen to be brushing your teeth, there's toothpaste. If you happen to be using the toilet, well, there is the One Wipe Charlie, which I have to admit I was very skeptical of. I had a routine that I was very happy with, that it served me good for the previous 33 years of my life. My routine has changed. The One Wipe Charlies are life-changing when it comes to using the toilet, and I cannot recommend them enough. I'll just leave it at that. They're great. They are wonderful, and you can only get them at Dollar Shave Club. Now, if you want to get things at Dollar Shave Club, you can do that now using my promo code, which is going to be Barnwell. And if you want to use that, for $5, you can get the Daily Essential Starter Set, which comes with the body cleanser, those One Wipe Charlies, which wipe, I want to say this quietly, your butt. Their world famous shave butter, and of course with Dollar Shave Club, their best razor, the 6-blade executive razor. And you can keep those blades coming for a few more bucks a month and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need for your trips to the bathroom. And you can check it out at dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. Get my promo code BARNWELL. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell and get your stuff for your bathroom today. All right, back here on the show with Mike Sando talking about the offseason grades he handed out in his ESPN column after talking to NFL executives and personnel men. I'm intrigued by the Ravens, who you gave a B-plus to, one of the top grades. And I, of course, we're going to have to find out what happens with Lamar Jackson. But I do have to admit that, you look at the biggest moves they made this offseason, where it was improving, really overhauling their wide receiving core by adding Michael Crabtree, John Brown, and Willie Snead. I'm not sure that they're really all that much better at receiver.
Yep. No, I agree with you on that front. I think the basis of the grade is, okay, you've got five quarterbacks taken in the first round, 1, 2, 3. You've got this handful of basically five quarterbacks, which is typical in most drafts, right? And we don't really know which one's going to be better than the others. We don't know. I mean, in the years past, we didn't know for sure if you should have taken Goff or Wentz or Winston or Mariota, or even going back to the drafts where it was Tannehill and Russell Wilson. You have a pile of guys, and no one really knows for sure if Josh Allen is the guy you should have. So Lamar Jackson looks like he's at least as talented as any of them. I mean, he may be more talented than any of them. And to get him at 32nd when you have longer-term questions about your quarterback, who's really about the most boring quarterback in the league, really, Joe Flacco. To me, I like that you got him at the end of the first round with tremendous upside, could possibly remake your entire offense and give you something to be excited about without having to do what Buffalo did to get in a position to get him. They kind of did the opposite, where they're moving around and I think they had to feel really good about what they came away with in the first round of the draft. So that's the basis for the grade. Mm-hmm. It's Lamar Jackson's upside, and it's not necessarily, it's probably an A if I felt like they did a great job on their receivers or the other places they needed to address.
Right, yeah, and you sort of mentioned this with the Cardinals as well, who got a high grade. They traded up for Josh Rosen and didn't have to give up an exorbitant amount relative to the Bills or the Jets in terms of trading up for their quarterback.
Yep, absolutely, and Arizona, I've heard nothing but amazing things about Josh Rosen, how he looks, and they may have the all-time best 7-on-7 offense ever with Rosen and Bradford. I mean, you're really going to be amazed this offseason, but the issues with Rosen, are longer term. Are the knocks against him in terms of durability, in terms of how he interacts with others, going to drag him down long term? And we don't know, but for now, you've got to feel really good about probably having the best just NFL-ready passer of the quarterbacks in the draft. And like you said, they traded up and didn't even pay a premium, which is unusual when you're trading up for a quarterback. So I sort of applaud that, and that's the basis for them having a good grade, because they really were the team that needed the quarterback almost the most. I mean, they had Carson Palmer retire, their coach leave, hired a defensive coach. You better get a quarterback. And it feels like they're sort of the team of great escapes. They somehow had Kurt Warner. They somehow finagled Carson Palmer. And now they've kind of finagled Josh Rosen out of this deal, when if you would have asked people at the combine, would Arizona get Josh Rosen, you'd say, yeah, are they trading up to 5 or 3, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what you would have said?
Of course.
And so I give them applause for that.
Yeah, and this is a team that went 8-8 last year with Blaine Gabbert and Drew Stanton starting 9 of 16 games. So, I mean, you figure if they can get steadier quarterback play with Bradford or Rosen or some combination of both, they could be a competitive team still. Minnesota Vikings, you gave a B to, and I have to admit, I'm maybe a little higher on their offseason, just because you think, getting Kirk Cousins without having to trade any players or any draft picks to do so, just giving away money, but spending a significant amount of money, even if the isn't a bargain, just not giving up any other assets seems like it's a really valuable opportunity. And then they got Sheldon Richardson on a pretty team friendly 1-year deal.
Yeah. So here was the thinking of why. This is a little bit of a backlash against everybody saying, oh my goodness, A+, and I felt like, hey, wait a minute here. Kirk Cousins last year was not as good as Case Keenum last year.
Sure.
I mean, Kirk Cousins, now you had this perfect mix where Pat Shurmur and this scrappy quarterback who avoided the rush and made your line look better than it was, just hit on it, and you had this, and maybe you couldn't have kept it going. Maybe it was a 1-year thing. But now you're throwing this sort of odd mix where you bring in DeFilippo from the Eagles and then Stefanski, your guy on staff who probably was in line or maybe should have been the natural coordinator, is now working under him. And then you bring in Kirk Cousins, who's, I think, a little quirky into the mix. And now we're like, all of a sudden, this is anointing. I mean, I feel like Kirk Cousins has to prove that he's sort of in that second tier. Mm-hmm. Because if he's at the top of that third tier and you're paying that kind of money and changing the way contracts are done with this $84 million deal, I don't know. I mean, I give him a solid B. I think it's a good move. It's a good off season, but I don't think it's just a slam dunk. And how are they going to win more games than they won last year?
No, I don't think so. I think what it does for me is it doesn't necessarily raise their ceiling, because we saw that last year. When they get quarterback play, the level they got from Case Keenum last year, they're so good elsewhere that even with Dalvin Cook getting injured, they were so good on defense, so solid with their offensive core that they were able to be a really impressive football team. I think what it does is it raises their floor. It's not hard for me to imagine a year where Case Keenum, regresses in a lot of ways, is much more similar to the guy we saw a year ago or 2 or 3 years ago, and where he's a mediocre quarterback. And suddenly they're getting mediocre quarterback play, and now they're a team that's basically the NFC Jaguars, maybe, where that's good, but it's not necessarily as good as they were a year ago. With Cousins, even if he doesn't necessarily have that, Aaron Rodgers level upside, it just seems like he's certainly more consistent than Keenum. And so, he raises the floor for them where maybe they are a 9-win team 70% of the time. Maybe they get a little higher than that, assuming Cousins doesn't get injured.
To me, when you go 3 years, $84 million fully guaranteed, you're going to be measured by the ceiling.
Yeah, that's true.
And the floor is nice, but when we walk into the house and we're showing the house, we're not saying check out this floor. We're saying look at the vaulted ceilings. And to me, they paid for a vaulted ceiling. And so at the end of this, no one's going to say, yeah, but guess what? They went 9-7. The floor was higher. You know what I mean? I feel like they're a 9-7 team if they bring back Case Keenum. So they've got to be better than that. I'm not 100% sure they are, but I think they might be. And that's why it's a B grade, it's not a negative grade. It's just not a anointing grade.
All right, that's fair enough. Well, let's talk about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, another team in that B tier with the Vikings. Not another team where I felt like, given their weaknesses heading into this offseason, I kind of like what they did, especially along the defensive line. Suddenly that's a thing that's been a weakness around Gerald McCoy for years now. Suddenly they're deep on the interior and on the outside at defensive line.
Yep, I think they easily could be a B+. There was a little bit of I like the fact that they paid more attention to this year to the chemistry of their team and just the types of people that they were adding. And I felt like that was a little bit of a reversal from last offseason when they were sort of the Rams, the yes. team that was making all these moves that got people excited about. So I did like that. I think the only reason it wasn't a little bit higher grade is, with the first round pick, from Washington, you're taking a defensive tackle relatively early in the draft. Is he going to be a really good three down player? Is he going to be the type of guy you re-sign, or are you going to, in the end, are you going to be saying, hey, good player, but we need a little bit more of a pass rush from him to be what, to really have the value? And I think you wonder too, what does JPP have left at this stage? I think it's a nice addition. I think it's important for them to have a good year, or a lot of people could be, compromised in terms of there could be big changes there. So that had a little bit of a short-term feel to it, but I understand it. I mean, they had to get better at outside rusher, and I think they are better.
All right, so Bucks, I think we're, I can see your point about Vita Vea. He's not necessarily going to be a J.J. Watt level interior force, and that's where they picked him, right in that draft pick range. So, but I do like the depth. I do think it's at least a coherent plan for a defense that was last in DVOA on the defensive side of the ball last season. We talked about the Cardinals. We talked about the Ravens trading up, not having to give up all that much to get their quarterback in the draft. The Jets, we can't really make that same case. Moved up from 6 to 3, did get Sam Darnold in the long run, but gave up 3 second round picks in the process. I don't really mind that all that much necessarily. Mm-hmm. What I would say though is, do you think they've given Sam Darnold enough in terms of his receiving core and his offensive line?
I don't. I mean, yeah, you can't fix everything at once, especially when you're giving away a bunch of your picks. So I don't think that they did do enough there. And when you look at, in fact, it's funny, I had the same conversation with someone in the league, and they're like, who do they got a receiver again? And I looked it up, and I had to look it up to get the full depth chart. I didn't know all the names. So I think that's usually a sign, you know, when you're just sort of stumped when you're asked about the depth chart at the position. So, yeah, I think that's tough. But, you know, they did get, I think, a quarterback who you easily could have seen taken number one overall. And if the Browns had taken a number one overall, people probably would have liked their draft even better than they liked it. So,
yeah.
Give him credit for that. No one's going to care what you paid, but if he's the right guy. But you're right. They are in sort of an odd spot, I think, to me, in the building of their team, and that is going to be something they're going to – are they going to be the Bears next offseason, you know what I mean, where you're really having to play catch-up to try to help your guy?
Yeah, and I think the other thing the Bears did this offseason, of course, is make some coaching changes, try to bring in some coaches who might do a better job of developing Mitchell Trubisky. And I think with the quarterback situation in New York, I don't know if there's that infrastructure in terms of the coaching as well.
Bates
is someone who was out of the league for several years, wasn't coaching, and then has just come back and become an offensive coordinator again. And Josh McCown, who they're paying a lot of money to, granted, seems like a very nice guy, has that reputation as someone who could develop a quarterback, but they're paying him a lot more than they're paying their coaches, and he's someone who hasn't necessarily developed any one of the players around him into a quarterback in the past. So it seems like it makes sense, but I just don't necessarily know that there's the right coaching infrastructure there to develop Sam Darnold yet.
Yep, I do agree with that, too. You've got a defensive head coach, then you're bringing in Jeremy Bates, who doesn't have a ton of years as a offensive schemer, you know, in terms of being a coordinator in the NFL.
Right.
And then what else is there? I do agree. I think that's a fair concern. I love having Josh McCown there. I think that's much better than if you didn't have him there. If you just had three young guys, that wouldn't be the way to go. I think McCown will be an asset. I think McCown showed last season that, I mean, he was better than anticipated.
For sure.
You know, what was he, 5-8 as a starter or something? I mean, I think with that team, that's pretty darn good. So if he can just play some average ball for them and help smooth the transition for Darnold, that's a success. But Darnold, you're right. Darnold is not set up to come in and light the world on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's still a lot more to be done for the Jets in the, like you said, the next offseason. They could be this year's Bears. The Jaguars, a team that I think last year really nailed their offseason in a lot of different ways. This year, I have to admit I'm skeptical. I like the idea of signing Andrew Norwell. It makes sense. You want to run the ball a lot. You have a hole at guard. You let Patrick Omame leave. You sign a guy who's an all-pro. But you think about the last few years, I mean, this is a guy who wasn't a Pro Bowler at any point in his career before 2017. And the Panthers, looking at Andrew Norwell and Trey Turner, said, well, we'd rather sign Trey Turner and let Andrew Norwell leave. So, I mean, he's being paid like one of the highest paid guards in football. We'll see what happens there. I don't mind the idea, but the price might necessarily not be the best deal. And then I think I'm more concerned about what they did at receiver, where you let Allen Robinson leave, and you even mentioned the executives felt this as well. I haven't met anybody who understands the Dante Moncrief decision as of yet.
I agree, and that's been universally pointed as one of the worst deals in years. So I agree, but the one thing about the Jaguars is, almost more than any team, they know who they are and who they want to be, and that's going to be a team that runs the ball, plays defense, and doesn't screw it up in the quarterback position. I believe the AFC Championship game was the first game all last season that they lost where Bortles didn't throw a pick. I mean, they were like 10-0 or something.
Wow.
And so that's where they're at. They're going to minimize the quarterback position, and the guard move is consistent with that. Does that mean every team should do it? No. But they're kind of set up to be the team to do it. And, you know, they drafted the back last year, and that's just how they're going to be. I agree with you at wide receiver, but I also don't think their season hinges on their wide receivers.
That's true.
So what I want to see is, you know, do they have some of the young guys in place for a year or two from now when you're not bringing back, you know, Malik Jackson, or when Calais Campbell's winding down or isn't there anymore. I think that's what they're going to be facing, and that's what they're addressing a little bit in the draft. But in the meantime, can you win a championship with Blake Bortles while you still have Tom Brady in the AFC? Good luck to you. And I also don't know, though, what else I would have done. You know, would you have gotten a different quarterback? I don't know that I would have for way more money, you know?
Yeah.
So they were sort of a team that's stuck in a good place, but can they get to a great place?
Yeah, maybe we could be sitting here in a year and wondering why they extended Bortles for another season, why they extended Tom Coughlin, Doug Caldwell, and Doug Marrone for another year when none of them were close to having their contracts expire. But we could be sitting here and saying they were that close and they brought everyone back and they took that kind of that last little leap over the wall. I mean, this is a team that really should have won the AFC Championship game with Blake Bortles at quarterback. So I understand why they did some of the moves, but I don't know that necessarily. It seems like they're maybe a little higher on the guys they had last year than I am, but they have the right to be, you know, right to be that high as well. The Saints, a team that you gave a B-2 as well. I have to admit, even before, I believe he has an injury right now, but the Marcus Davenport trade really colors this offseason for me with the Saints.
Yeah, and not in a positive way, I wouldn't think. I mean, maybe he's going to be the next great thing, but it seemed like a classic maneuver of we're one player away from getting over the top, and we have a very short window. You're kind of making decisions for the wrong reason, it felt like to me, and do those pan out? You know, I think that was a lot to give up, and, you know, we'll see. Maybe they're right, maybe they're close. They are a team that's close, but that just felt like not good fundamentals.
It seems like you have to really be confident about a pass rusher having an immediate impact. And Marcus Davenport, even the people who like him, you know, seem to think that he is a project, that someone who could be a potential star pass rusher in the long run, but not necessarily a guy who's going to be a plug and play, you know, Von Miller day one superstar pass rusher. But we'll see. I mean, the Saints had a fantastic offseason last year, so I'm not surprised necessarily that they're sort of, again, a team that believes in themselves and believes that their read is maybe right than more others. Chiefs, another team in the same situation. Not necessarily that they went out and traded for one guy, but that their free agent moves two significant additions at premium cost in Sammy Watkins and Anthony Hitchens. And, you know, I don't know that those guys are necessarily game breakers at their respective positions right now.
Oh, totally agree. Now, I think that Watkins has played better than his numbers have been.
Sure.
And you know, that's, you know, I've talked to evaluators and coaches in the league who've watched the tape and said, the guy's running open. He's playing really well. But that, you know what? At the same time, that's two places that he's been, and he's been doing those things and hasn't had the production you'd expect to go with it. So is that going to suddenly change? I think you're banking on Andy Reid, who's a pretty good guy to bank on. You know, I feel like Andy Reid's probably going to, he got the most out of Alex Smith, and to make the move they made to Mahomes, he's got to feel great about that, and then he's going to have a specific plan for what to do with Watkins. And I realized too that it wasn't the best wide receiver draft, so all of those things sort of came together, but they look like a team that is going to just try to outscore you and be exciting and try to score 30 points. And I don't know if they're going to be able to do that consistently enough with the young quarterback when your defense seems to be clearly in retreat a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team where you looked at their cornerback situation last year and said, well, that's a major problem. They went out and signed Darrell Revis late in the season and had him playing meaningful snaps heading into the postseason. And then now somehow their cornerback situation is worse. They did get Kendall Fuller in the Alex Smith trade, but David Emerson is not up to the caliber of Marcus Peters, who was traded. So I do have some major question marks about that secondary. I will say, though, a team that did address secondary, and I think had a very good offseason, maybe a little higher than the C-plus grade you gave them, Green Bay Packers, who did draft two cornerbacks in the first two rounds. Again, they managed to trade down and pick up a first-round pick in the process. They swapped out Dom Capers for Mike Pettine, who has a very good record as a defensive coordinator, and got Mo Wilkerson up front to a one-year team-friendly deal. So what am I missing here? Are there any reasons to be skeptical of what the Packers did this offseason?
Yeah, I'm going to be a little critical of the grade here. I think the grade is lower because of some longer-term Packers fatigue. And the Packers fatigue is explained in the item, basically that they just keep dumping all of these resources into the secondary. Is this the year that it's going to be different? You know, and I think one of the one of the interesting things about them and about Cleveland is they both have D coordinators who are steering them towards putting all of these resources into the corner and secondary position. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating to me because you got teams like Atlanta, Seattle, San Diego, who, while they have sometimes put a lot of resources into the secondary, don't have to at corner by the nature of their scheme. And so to me, where is this Packers pass rush going to come from? Mm-hmm. You're just sending, funneling more and more picks into the secondary. And I don't know that I feel like their secondary is totally fixed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably better with what they've done this time, but it just kind of felt a little bit like more of the same.
Yeah, I could certainly see that. I think the hope is maybe, at least if I'm thinking about it from a positive perspective, that Pettine is the guy who might be able to change things, that Dom Capers might not have been the best fit there. And I understand the fatigue thing, and, you know, I certainly, you can't sit there and say, well, they fixed it, plug and play, we're solved, game's over, you know, they're going to be in great shape. But certainly the fact that they didn't come back with the same guys we saw last year is hopefully a positive as well.
Yeah, did you like the... You know, they went for Fuller, didn't get him. Did that delay them from getting any veterans in the market? I'd have to go back and look. But that also felt like a move that wasn't a move, you know?
Right.
They just got the deal done for the Bears.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, I have issues with how the Bears handled that situation. But I maybe a positive, because you look at Kyle Fuller was a guy who, you know, was basically trade bait last year. This time last year was the guy who figured was going to be, you know, on the market for a very low salary, and then had a great year, and now is suddenly getting paid like a top five, top six cornerback. So could be a blessing in disguise. Yeah. We'll certainly see. But
yeah, I want to ask you one more thing. Do you love dumping Jordy and bringing in Jimmy Graham? Did you love that, or like it, or just okay?
I was going to ask you the same question. That was the next thing I was going to ask you. So I'll answer first, but I want to hear what you think as well. I'm of two minds of it. You know, certainly it's hard to judge him. Given that it was Brett Hundley as opposed to Aaron Rodgers, and you'd figure even if it was a healthy Jordy Nelson, even if it was a 28-year-old Jordy Nelson as opposed to whoever old he is now, you'd figure he gets a boost from playing with Aaron Rodgers relative to guys, you know, to any other quarterback in football. But I have to admit that with Jimmy Graham, I'm skeptical that he is going to consistently be a guy who's going to get, you know, 9 or 10 red zone touchdowns a year, even though he has that skill set, even though he has the size naturally. Now he has a quarterback who's going to look for him in the red zone. You just don't see guys outside of Rob Gronkowski do that year after year, Jimmy Graham included. So I think we saw sort of the best example of a red zone threat when it came to Jimmy Graham in Seattle last year. And I just think that's going to be tough to keep up year after year.
Yeah. And so one of the things I did was looked at Jordy Nelson in his last 16 starts when Rodgers played, and it was 96 catches, well over 1,000 yards, 14 touchdowns.
That's pretty good.
Now, that may be unrealistic. He may be declining, injury-prone, and no one's going to know Jordy Nelson better than the Packers do, mm-hmm. right? So you give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt there. I just felt like there's obviously a great rapport and chemistry and feel-goodness between your quarterback, Rodgers, and Nelson. I feel like Jimmy Graham is probably going to show up in the red zone, but you don't have any of that. And they both averaged about 9 yards a catch last year. The difference right. was obviously one guy's a receiver who should probably average more than Nelson, but one guy was playing with Russell Wilson, mm-hmm. and that guy, Jimmy Graham, wasn't exactly lighting the world on fire until he got into the red zone.
Right.
And so is that enough to make it justified to me? I don't know. They're giving him what, $10 million?
Yeah. It's the highest paid $10
million
a year. Yeah.
I'm a little ambivalent about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably another reason why it was a C+.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't love that deal either, so I do agree with you on that element of it. Let's talk about one more team. Let's get to the Raiders, who, of course, did sign Jordy Nelson this year. Also signed a lot of guys who might have been good in, not unfair to say good, but guys who were certainly better perhaps 4 or 5 years ago. Jordy Nelson, Leon Hall, Derek Johnson, Doug Martin. They did make some moves I was more enthused by. They liked signing Sharice Wright, who was very good last year in a limited sample. Mm-hmm. Tahir Whitehead, I think, a very underrated player. But, I mean, are there a lot of positives to take out of this offseason for the Raiders?
Well, that you, to me, big picture off the field, you're going to you're going to Vegas in a couple of years with some momentum because Gruden's exciting, and I think there's some value in that for your team. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how you can be excited about adding Derek Johnson or Bruno Giacomini or some of these older, declining players. Mm-hmm. I understand why Gruden did it. I mean, he wants to have a veteran leader in every room as he sets the culture and shows people how to do it in the NFL. And there's value in doing that. I just don't know if they make you better enough on the field to justify doing it across the board. And so that's probably the nature of the criticism and why the grade is only a C+. I thought they also were a team that took chances in the draft. You know, it seemed to be rolling the dice a little bit of the way the 49ers did in the past. You know, taking a Hurst, the defensive lineman, is a great value in wherever they got him, the fifth round. But there's other people that, because of his heart condition, wouldn't draft him if he's available in the seventh round.
Right.
So that's a risk. There's some risks like that you're taking. A couple of the other guys had some injury concerns as well. So you pair all those things together, and I think you have some questions.
Yeah, I think certainly there are some questions. It could work out. You know, obviously, you know, seems to be a plan here. And like you said, you know, having those veterans in different rooms and having, you know, sort of establishing a culture change and having Gruden and the players he's brought in be part of that makes sense. But we'll be intrigued. I mean, I have to admit, I'm pretty skeptical. I think even the Colton Miller pick in the first round, that was a guy who, mm-hmm. I think if you ask most teams, he would have been on the board later in the first round. And granted, offensive linemen are hard to come by. And, you know, he certainly has some upside. He certainly has the frame of a offensive lineman. But I think the big picture problem here is that you seem to have a disconnect where you have the Reggie McKenzie group that was running this team up to this point and the John Gruden group mm-hmm. that's coming in here. And there seems to be, you know, at least plenty of smoke that there is a, you know, sort of a culture fight happening there between those two sides, and that Gruden has perhaps more personnel power than it might have seemed coming in. And when you have a guy on a 10-year, $100 million contract, it's not necessarily surprising. But I wrote about this when Gruden was hired. I think for whatever you think about him as a coach, and I think he, you know, certainly proved his bona fides in Oakland the first time, in Tampa Bay, his personnel decisions were not as impressive. There was not a lot of great drafts when he was running personnel in Tampa. And so I have to admit that I'd be a little nervous if I was a Raiders fan if Gruden was going to be, you know, shopping for the groceries and then as well as
I think he's, there's no question he's in charge, and that's a place we need to look at a year from now to say, you know, we're not going to be surprised if a year from now there's a switch in the front office of some kind, you know what I mean? And somebody comes in just sort of like a lot of these teams where the head coach is kind of a, you know, Pete Carroll helped hire John Schneider, you know, or that's Andy Reid was not the guy they were going to get rid of in Kansas City. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that, I think that's the way it's going to be in Oakland, whether or not Reggie McKenzie stays long term, and we have to let it play out. But John's going to definitely be buying groceries. I don't think he came back to do anything else but have the power needed to cast the team in his image the way he wants to do it. They're fascinating to me because of the way John likes to play football is not the way football is trending. Yet at the same time, I've been around John a lot the last few years, and no one's been more interested in staying up on what's happening in the game, and no one's had more coaches come into his office and, you know, had him up at the whiteboard mm-hmm. showing all the different things they're doing. I mean, he's a big fan of what Andy Reid and Brad Childress did in Kansas City. Yet we know what he wants to be. So what's it going to look like? Mm-hmm. You know, how are they going to play? I don't think we really know for sure, but I really kind of want to see. I want to see how Derek Carr reacts to a fiery coach who can be tough on players. There's just a lot going on there that makes the kind of like the Rams. To me, they're just a really intriguing team, whether you buy it or not, what they're doing.
Yeah, really fascinating situation there. Well, Mike, I appreciate you coming on. Well, obviously, a lot of stuff coming up from you. Anything you want to plug here over the next couple of weeks or next month or so?
Well, we'll have quarterback tiers coming up as usual. So that's always one of my funnest projects. And I was actually on a call for that when right before we got on the air today. So I love doing that. It's fun, and we'll, of course, have that again, as we do every summer.
I'm excited. One of my favorite features of the year annually, the Quarterback Tiers column. And, Mike, you're on Twitter as well, of course.
Yep, Sando ESPN.
Tremendous. Well, Mike, thank you so much. We're going to come back with Mike Goodman here on the apparently the Mike and Mike show after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Of course, the World Cup is going on right now. It's something that's interesting me. I'm sure a lot of you are watching as well and naturally wanted to have someone on to talk about it. A frequent contributor to this show is going to be joining us of the Double Pivot podcast, of Stats Bomb, of many places. Mike Goodman is here. Mike, how are you?
Doing good. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Well, you're obviously a very busy man, so I'm just going to get straight to it. No long preamble. We're going to talk about some of the things we've seen so far. We're recording this after France's win over Peru in advance of the Argentina match show. So we're not going to talk about Argentina too much here because we don't know what's going to happen between the time that we record this and the time that we post this podcast. But let's start with a broader look. Let's start with maybe some of the bigger stories from this tournament. And it seems like the two most dominant factors when it comes to this tournament is video assisted replay, VAR, and own goals. And I assume that you're not for or against own goals, but what do you think about VAR's role in the tournament so far?
Yeah, I think it's a contentious issue for sure. Yes. And I think it's interesting because it's one of those issues where, like, American sports fans have a lot of experience sort of with the good and the bad of instant replay. Mm-hmm. It's actually going slightly better than I feared, and
really
the worst case scenario in my head. But there are lots of issues. So I think the major concern, right, is that so much of the soccer rule book and so many soccer calls are very subjective. Mm-hmm. And instant replay doesn't help a ton with that. You know, it just, so many calls are in that gray area, even when you look at them on instant replay. Mm-hmm. And I think they've avoided that problem for the most part by not going to replay very much. The rules are written so that you're supposed to go to replay if you think there is a reviewable call. Mm-hmm. And a call should only be turned, much like in American sports, if there's, you know, indisputable visual evidence or whatever the soccer term is. Mm-hmm. But what they've mostly done is only really go to replay conservatively when there's a good chance of a call being overturned. So that's good. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's still implementation issues. There's still been a couple of fairly questionable calls. So it hasn't disrupted the flow of the game a lot, which I think was a big concern. There are still issues around the actual calls themselves.
Right. And it's, you know, for me, I'm not someone who's particularly, I don't have a strong opinion on a lot of things, including replay when it comes to the NFL or soccer for that matter. I really didn't enjoy the South Korea-Sweden VAR decision because it was one of the rare times South Korea actually had a counterattack going, and it was, you know, obviously it would be crazy to say they were going to score from that counterattack, but they were in an advantageous situation and the play is brought to a halt so they can review the previous play, which was, ended up being a valid penalty, and I can't fault them for calling the penalty, but it seems like it can change just the nature of how the game is played. And with football, you know, with American football, obviously, it's, that game is stop and start anyway. So the idea that there's, you know, replays for things isn't really impacting the flow of the game all that much, but, we saw it impact the flow of the game there. And then I wonder if it's going to change the way the game is being called as well. I mean, there was that sort of that FIFA mandate to linesmen to basically, if a offsides call is close, let it go through. We've seen at least one goal that was ruled a goal on the field, overruled for offsides on replay. We've seen more penalties in this World Cup, it seems like. Is it a more aesthetically pleasing game or less aesthetically pleasing game with VAR involved?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think you're right that there are a number of, like, what I'd call second order effects that haven't been considered or particularly gamed out. And the South Korea example is a really good one where we haven't really thought about exactly how it impacts the flow of the game when you stop a counterattack, when you take a long time to go to replay. We haven't really thought of how the fact that close offsides are not going to get called on the field and will only be overturned by replay is going to impact the way the game technically works, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how long are you going to wait until you go back and overturn that call? If there's a counterattack going the other way, if there's a corner kick, do we go back beyond those things? Mm-hmm. That said, at least at the World Cup, the way they're calling it, they are calling it in a way to mitigate those second order conditions by just not going to it unless there's a really high degree of probability that the call is going to be overturned. Mm-hmm. That's not in the rules. That's just sort of how they're choosing to implement it. So I think long term, all of these like concerns are really live. But for the time being, I don't think they've had a tremendous impact on this particular World Cup yet, which probably just means they'll like affect England in a really important moment in the quarterfinals.
As they lose to it. Well, Poland, I guess, will be around in 16, but we'll see. Obviously, still more to come with VAR over the rest of the tournament. So we got VAR covered. Let's get to the teams in the tournament. But first, wanted to talk about our partners at SeatGeek. Of course, if you're a listener to the Bill Barnwell Show, if you listen to any podcast, really, but especially the Bill Barnwell Show, you know how important SeatGeek is. When I go somewhere, if I want to buy tickets to a game, I don't try and play on some connections. I don't call in any favors. I go to SeatGeek. I buy tickets just like any other civilian. And I get a good deal. I get great seats. And I know that I'm getting a ticket that's going to show up reliably on my phone within a matter of moments because SeatGeek is a reliable source of reliable tickets. If I'm saying reliable a lot, that's the word I want you to think of. Reliable when it comes to SeatGeek. You just have to go on your phone, go to SeatGeek.com, go to the event you want to go see, whether it's baseball, basketball, football, hockey, soccer, MMA, boxing, concerts, plays. I can't think of anything else that requires tickets, but unless it's your bingo game, it's going to involve tickets. SeatGeek's going to have tickets to that event. And even better, you're going to get those tickets rated with the DealScore technology. It's proprietary. There was an incredibly intense algorithm is the word I was thinking of. You're going to get ratings, so you know you're getting a good deal. You're not going to get some mediocre tickets and pay a ton of money for them. SeatGeek doesn't want that to happen. They want you to get the best seats at a great price. And even better, right now, you can go on SeatGeek and get $20 off your first purchase. Do that. Just go to the SeatGeek app, find the tickets you want to buy, and then enter in my promo code at checkout, which is Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, Barnwell, my last name. You'll get $20 back on your first SeatGeek purchase. It's a great deal. So head over to the SeatGeek app, go to SeatGeek.com. Wherever you want to purchase tickets, just make sure you use my promo code Barnwell to get $20 back on your first SeatGeek purchase today. So far, through two matches for some teams, one for others, the biggest surprise in the tournament, at least to me, is Russia, a team that was regarded as the host, obviously, maybe favored in some ways to get out of their own group, but not a particularly impressive team on paper. But through two matches, 8 goals scored, 1 goal against in two matches, pretty good. Are you impressed with Russia relative to your expectations heading into the tournament itself?
It's hard. They haven't played anybody who's remotely good.
Sure.
I mean, Saudi Arabia are probably the worst team in the tournament. Egypt with Mo Salah just coming back from injury. Again, not a strong team. They have been more impressive, certainly on the scoreboard than you would expect. Mm-hmm. They have not, to me, been impressive in a way that makes me think that they are once challenged by a good team. Necessarily going to surprise. So they were one of the favorites to get out of the group before the tournament. They're going to get out of the group. They're certainly getting out of the group in a more impressive way than expected, but it doesn't particularly make me think that like they're going to be a surprise semifinalist or something.
Is there something they could do in the near future that would impress you?
I mean, if in the final game of the group stage, if they were to like handle Uruguay's physicality in a way, you know, Uruguay are a very good defensive team, and I assume they'll be committed to trying to win the match because winning the group means that they'll face the runner-up from Group B instead of the Group B winners. So that's, I mean, there is something to play for in that match. So yeah, I think that it is a step up in class for Russia playing Uruguay, and if they look impressive there, then maybe you have to start to reevaluate.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side, is there a nation that has surprised you so far, at least, again, the limited sample of this tournament, in a way that you do think you genuinely have a higher opinion of them than you did heading into the tournament?
Yeah, I think Senegal was better than I expected them to be as they beat Poland. You know, there's a tremendous amount of talent on that team. Sadio Mane is probably the most well-known player, Liverpool's winger. But they had a tendency to play Mane centrally, which can work, but he had sort of become a second striker for them often instead of doing the linking up play that they needed. And that had sort of cascading effects that made them lose, you know, sort of both their coherent attack and oftentimes then sort of defending on counterattack situations, they would become quite open. They played him out on the wing in their first match against Poland, and that really made a difference. And they looked quite impressive. And given the way that group has broken out, they have a really good chance to come out of the group now. Mm-hmm. And they just look better than I expected them to.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with that group where Japan pulled an upset over Colombia, helped by a third-minute red card, Senegal beat Poland. You would have maybe, I would imagine, figured that Poland and Colombia might be the favorites to come out of that group, and now it looks entirely
different. Yeah, that was certainly the pre-tournament wisdom. Poland with Robert Lewandowski had been a good qualifying team. They'd scored a lot of goals. Lewandowski's a really good striker. And Senegal really, really strangled them. The challenge, of course, is that they look the teams that come out of that group play most likely Belgium and England in some combination or other. And those are both good teams. So, I mean, I don't know that I would necessarily expect Senegal to stage a big upset at that point, but I think even getting out of the group stage is an achievement.
Mm, of course. On the flip side, or I guess on the flip side, there is certainly no shortage of big countries who've got off disappointing starts one way or another. Whether they've been gaining points or not is another question, but let's run through them really quickly, and I want to see if, like I said, based on your opinion on them before the tournament and what we've seen so far, whether we're one match or two, if that's changed. And let's start with Germany, who played maybe the most entertaining match outside of the Portugal-Spain match in this tournament, 1-0 loss to Mexico. Really an entertaining match, but Mexico seemed to genuinely outplay them for the vast majority of that match. 1-1-0 could have won, you know, could have scored two or three times, if not for a couple of missteps here or there. Are you concerned about Germany? Is there a change they can make versus what we saw against Mexico?
Yeah, the really concerning thing for Germany is even more than the result, because sometimes weird results happen, mm-hmm. that Mexico exploited a weakness that coming into the tournament, you would have said, okay, if there's any weakness for Germany, mm-hmm. it's having no real defensive midfielders. And that's exactly what Mexico used to sort of pry them apart repeatedly. Germany have options to fix that problem. They have a number of very good players. None of them are particularly defensive midfielders. So what it looks like they're going to do for their second match is start Ilkay Gundogan in there instead of Sami Khedira alongside Toni Kroos. That is a change that doesn't necessarily fix the problem. Mm-hmm. And while they may get away with it because they're playing Sweden, it is something to watch for, and it is something that definitely raises alarm bells. It's not a situation where you say, okay, Germany can just do the things that they usually do and they'll be fine. It's a problem that they have to solve. Whether Gundogan does that, whether they need to go to somebody like Sebastian Rudi, who's actually a defensive midfielder, whether they need to do something more radical and change formations or move Joshua Kimmich from right back inside. They have options to fix the problem, but there's definitely a problem that needs fixing.
Do you think they should consider changing their shape?
I think I would not, but it is a viable option. Mm-hmm. And the problem is now you're balancing being, you know, making real radical changes to what you do and how you play versus, you know, more conservative but perhaps ill-fitting solutions. And there's no good answer to that question. I think I would prefer just playing a slightly worse player like Sebastian Rudi who fits into the system that you do. But, you know, it's sort of indicative of the fact that there's a real problem here, that you're sort of grasping for these more esoteric, sort of less normal solutions to the problem.
What was their formation by the end of the match against Mexico?
4-1, lots of attackers. And I think that sort of made sense given the situation, and they kind of got away with it. But that's not like a viable solution when you're not chasing a game, right? Like, they have tons of attackers they can throw on the field, and they could have scored a goal and got a draw out of that match. They ended up not. But, you know, the problem that they need to resolve is exactly the thing that led, right? They moved away. They just went way more attacking. And I guess, like, they could try to just play super open, but that's not what they do either. I mean, they like to play a very controlled possession-oriented game most of the time. Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. Brazil drew 1-1 with Switzerland. Neymar was fouled, I believe, 1,000 times in that match and currently has an ankle injury that forced him out of practice a couple days ago. Are you concerned about Brazil with or without Neymar being fit in the starting 11?
So they have announced that Neymar is going to start their next match. I am concerned that the very specific situation of Brazil starting Neymar, who is not 100%, is the way this tournament goes wrong for Brazil. Mm-hmm. They are a very strong and coherent team that is built around Neymar. They could also be a strong and coherent team without Neymar in the lineup. But if you're playing him, he's going to see a lot of the ball. And if he sees a lot of the ball and isn't 100%, that's the way Brazil breaks down. So maybe Neymar's fine. Maybe, you know, he's coming back from injury. Maybe he's playing himself back into shape. You know, Brazil are still likely to win their group. They have a little bit of wiggle room. If Neymar's not 100%, I would be concerned about them. But if Neymar is just sort of playing his way back to health, I think Brazil will be fine.
If you were going to sit him for a match and rest him and rest that ankle, wouldn't it be the match against Costa Rica as opposed to the match against Serbia, though?
I think there's equal arguments for both. Mm-hmm. Serbia is the better team. Costa Rica is the team that is more likely to injure Neymar.
That's true.
Right? I mean, there are sort of arguments in either direction. But there are, you know, I think Brazil just sort of, you want to lock in making sure you advance. So if Neymar is okay to go, I certainly understand playing him in this match.
Mm-hmm. They're still 85% to qualify, 55% to win the group per 538, so still in pretty good shape, but certainly not the most impressive performance against Switzerland. What about Spain? And I feel weird saying this because Spain has 4 points. They're in good shape, but they drew 3-3 with Portugal, blew a lead, obviously, to that late Cristiano Ronaldo free kick. And then against Iran, I don't know that they were the better team, even though they won 1-0. So is there something missing with Spain for you right now?
I think that Iran put in a very good defensive performance, but yes, Spain were not as dynamic as you would have wanted them to be. Spain are going to play the way they always play. They're going to put tons of central midfielders out there. They're going to try to possess the ball a lot. If they have a lead, they are not necessarily going to try to grow that lead. I think it can often be a misconception that a team that wants to have a lot of the ball is very attacking. Mm-hmm. And Spain, throughout their sort of run for the last 15 years, have not been that. They are perfectly happy to take a 1-0 lead and then try to kill the game off by passing the ball around. It didn't work all that well against Iran, and Iran are a strong defensive team who have one good counterattacking player, and I think they probably got more, you know, attacking chances against Spain than we should all be comfortable with. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, this is what Spain do. And so I'm not worried about them per se, but I do think that if you're looking, if you're trying to like identify small margins deep in the tournament, you know, could they get upset by a slightly worse team in the quarterfinals? You know, maybe, you know, you look at a team like Germany or, you know, Portugal, if they face each other in the finals or whatever, and you say, hey, look, these other good teams, do you see something that might give them an edge? I think the answer there might be maybe. But I'm not particularly concerned about sort of Spain's immediate future in the tournament.
I see. So I mentioned that Ronaldo free kick goal, of course, a hat trick in the first match against Spain, scored the winner in the second group match for Portugal. 4 goals for him in this tournament. Only had 1, of course, in each of his first 3 tournaments. I mean, obviously, in those other tournaments, he had more of an impact than just scoring goals. We had the winning penalty in 2006 in their quarterfinals, I believe. Man of the match in all 3 of their group stage matches in 2010, I believe. Injured in 2014, was not his usual self. But this is a guy who's 33 years old, who just played a full season for Madrid in multiple different competitions. Are we spoiled that he's able to pull this off?
Yeah, I think we are. I think this is also a little bit of a testament to the way he has evolved his own game over the course of his career. Mm-hmm. He's a pretty pure striker these days. You know, the previous tournaments, he was a winger. He was a hybrid winger who scored goals. So if his team was struggling in some capacity, a lot of what that meant is he would be picking the ball up far away from goal and his teammates would then not be getting on the end of the passes that he provided. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, that's just not really going to happen a lot. If Portugal struggle, what will end up happening is Ronaldo will not get a ton of touches of the ball as he sort of stays higher up the field and around the opposing goal. Mm-hmm. And if Portugal don't struggle, he's going to have a lot of opportunities to score goals. And he's turned himself into maybe the best pure striker in the world. And I think you're sort of, you know, being a great pure striker doesn't guarantee you're going to score goals. I mean, look at what happened to Paul and Robert Lewandowski. But if your team is playing well, that's where it's going to show up. And I think that's really what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So last question for you, Mike, before we wrap up here. Of the remaining second set of fixtures, so the matches that are still coming up, is there one that really stands out to you as one you really want to pay attention to, just in terms of either a team making a tactical change or a team that really has a lot to play for, might be in worse shape than we're expecting? Any match you're really looking forward to from this second set of fixtures?
I mean, the obvious answer here is the match that almost everybody listening to this will have already watched by the time they heard it. They hear this, and that's Argentina-Croatia. We can certainly say that Argentina have been somewhat of a mess coming off a draw against Iceland. And Croatia looked pretty good in their match against Nigeria. So that matchup is really going to determine the course of the group. And it is hard for me sitting here in advance to think that Argentina will come away looking good, even if they win. So that's what I'm watching, although everybody listening to this will already have the benefit of knowing how it turned out.
For you and I, though, we can revel in the idea that you're going to be excited by this match. I'm excited for Germany-Sweden. I think I want to see what Germany does, if they change things, if they look differently than they did against Mexico.
I was tempted to say that, but I think deep down, I don't think that Sweden is the type of opponent that's going to test the German weakness the way Mexico did. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that even a good performance from Germany will tell us much, mm-hmm. as opposed to, I think there are a number of good teams that we haven't even talked about. England, Belgium, whose next rounds will continue to give us a little bit more information about how good we think they are. Mm-hmm. England played extremely well and are now going to go up against a poor Panama team who's going to defend a lot. And we're going to see again if they can break down a team. Belgium scored 3 goals, but they didn't look cohesive. They scored 3 goals because they have great players. And again, they're going to go up against the defensive Tunisia team, which is another test to see if they can sort of attack coherently. And so those are the kind of matchups that I look at and I say, okay, those are matches that are going to tell me more about, even if the result is what I expect, I'm going to continue to learn more about these teams going forward.
I feel like we're entering very dangerous ground by complimenting England so frequently here on the show, though.
England are good. I mean, England are a good team. They may not – look, England being a good team places them around 5th or 6th in the tournament, right, mm-hmm. in terms of sort of skill level and expectation. So if England go out in, the quarterfinals, they could be a good team and go out in the quarterfinals. England are a well-drilled, cohesive unit with a couple of very dynamic attacking players.
This is such a dangerous game. I agree with you, but I also – You know what I'm going to say. They're like it's like England's going to lose to Senegal in the round of 16 or something crazy like that. I'm just nervous about complimenting England.
The fun thing about England is that the quintessential thing about them is that they always find a different way to lose, right? Mm-hmm. And it's been a long time since you could say the thing that happened to England is they were really good and got weirdly upset.
Yes. Fair.
4 years ago, they were not that good when they went out in the group stage. Before that, you've had sort of multiple times where they've sort of been okay and lost to a good team in disappointing ways. Mm-hmm. 2010, there was the goal that wasn't against Germany. So being really good and getting upset would be a new and novel way for England to sort of disappoint at a World Cup.
Very promising future for England here on the show. Well, Mike, of course, it was a pleasure to have you on. You're doing a million things during the World Cup, but any of them you want to plug here?
Sure. We've got the Double Pivot podcast, which you can find on Twitter at Double Pivot Pod. Subscribe where you get your podcasts. That's me and Michael Cayley, and we nerd out about all things sort of soccer and analytics. You can find my writing, and I'm the managing editor at statsbomb.com, which is a soccer stats and analytics site. And any place else that has soccer coverage, The Athletic, 538, The Action Network, I am all of those places. So, yeah, I'm busy.
All right, well, we'll let you go, Mike. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Beth.